Someone told you knee pain is just getting older? They were wrong. The Joint Relief Institute offers fast joint pain relief covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on this sunny Wednesday afternoon in downtown Chicago. Is the future sunny? That's what the Fed is looking at. They're meeting today and wrapping up. You heard Steve Alexander talking about that. And Terry Savage is on a phone line as well, joins us. TerrySavage.com, The Huffington Post, Channel 9, just about anywhere. Tribune Media, right? Tribune Publishing, you've got a column with them as well, Terry?
Absolutely, and I just posted a new column called "Fed in the Box."
Is there a media outlet? This is your favorite one, is it not?
This is my favorite thing to do with you because first of all, I don't just put on makeup, and second of all, you're so much fun to talk to.
Yeah, you look great today, I have to say.
Thank you, I appreciate
that. Okay, so we're waiting for the Fed, right? We might hear something a little bit less than an hour from now, and this is one of those.
It will.
These statements where every word and every nuance will be looked at and parsed and tried to figure them out to see where the future might hold. And what do you expect for them to say?
You know, everybody is waiting to hear what they will say and what they can't say. When I wrote this column this morning, I was thinking about it. I think that we're learning something about the Fed. We think about how powerful they are. But, you know, in The Wizard of Oz, when they drew back the curtain and realized, oh, the wizard wasn't so great. I think we're at a moment like that for the Fed. The Fed in December, I mean, all through last year, insisted the economy was getting stronger. They were looking at the data. In December, it was strong enough to raise rates. And two things. Number one, nothing happened when they raised interest rates in the interest rate market. I mean, savers aren't getting any more money. Credit card interest rates didn't come down. Mortgage rates actually have gone down a little bit, and the Treasury, 10-year Treasury, the basis on which everything else in the economy kind of moves, is about unchanged. The Fed didn't have any impact with its rate increase, except for one thing. It made the dollar stronger, made our exports, therefore, more expensive. People in foreign countries have to scrape together more currency to get $1 worth of U.S. goods or soybeans, so our wheat and so forth aren't selling as well. And ironically, the Fed really may have slowed the economy. And now since December, we have some news. I mean, economic growth is really less than 1% in the fourth quarter. We have no inflation. We have energy prices coming down. So everybody's watching. We know they're not going to raise rates today.
Right.
Nobody thought they would. Will they raise them in March? But more important, is the Fed just pushing against a string?
Well,
the rest of the world's in deflation. It's in slowing economies. Europe's trying to get its economy going. Japan, South America, all over, economies are like in a great slowdown. And the Fed raised rates. I would like to see them apologize and say we made a mistake.
But not drop them again.
They won't do that.
They're not going to go back, right? Haven't we always been saying, though, that raising the rates is just we've got to take our medicine, we've got to get this done so that when they need to step in, they've got somewhere to go?
Well, so that's the point about the Wizard of Oz analogy. The Fed has literally put itself in a box. Raising rates does not get our economy back to normal. The whole world is kind of slowing and making the U.S. a more attractive place to send your money isn't doing anything good for us. It raises the dollar, but that's about all. And the Fed doesn't have any, I mean, they've blustered and they've made pronouncements and they raised rates and nothing's happening in the bond market. The stock market is down because of fears of economic weakness. So what can the Fed do now? That's fascinating. If it weren't important to each and every one of us that our economy grow and to create jobs, it would just be only a fascinating intellectual exercise.
So it'd be fun to watch if it didn't hurt a little bit.
Exactly. It matters. It matters what the Fed does, and we'd like for them to be powerful.
Well, it's hurting a lot of people right now, people with portfolios, and they're watching Wall Street. I know that's something else you wrote about this past week, about if you are holding stocks, what do you do now? And I think generally the advice is don't do anything right now.
Well, you know, that's not exactly the advice I want to give, which is strange. I mean, in 2008, 2009, you know, I was a rock and a pillar about don't do anything now. That was really a painful time. And those who stuck it out and kept contributing and so forth came out very well. But I have a slightly different message. My message remains the same for those who are who work and contribute to a 401k plan. You're not using this money. You're not retiring for 15 years or 20 years, maybe even 10 years. You're getting the opportunity with the market down now to buy stocks at lower prices. But I actually kind of do worry for those who are in retirement, approaching retirement very closely, and particularly for those who are going to be facing withdrawals from their IRAs. And I think, you know, we've had this nice bounce back. It's entirely possible the stock market will go back to its old highs. But I think what you're getting is an opportunity now, while it's sort of quiet at the moment, to take a look and say, what's my time horizon? Even if I'm retiring, let's say at 65, I'd like to believe I have a 20-year time horizon for some of my money. And that sum belongs in the stock market. But balancing things out is more important than ever these days as we face an uncertain political future and as the Fed is demonstrating it doesn't have the power to help us lead the world. So I'm actually becoming a little more conservative for retirees. I've always been, you know, that's the concept of chicken money.
Right.
You don't get paid for that.
I love chicken
but
money.
I think it's more important to rebalance right now at today's. We're down 20% from the all-time highs.
Okay, so that is contrary to, I mean, because one of the first things you always say is don't react when things are happening quickly.
Yeah, well, they're not today.
Yeah, but they might, but they are. If you look at the year so far, things have been happening pretty quickly.
Well, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. If I had known in December at the moment of the Fed rate increase, I wrote columns about that at year end. You've had huge gains. Consider taking something off the table. So here's your question to yourself right now. Assuming you fit in the category of this is my retirement money, and in 3 or 5 years I won't be putting more money in, so I won't be able to take advantage of lower prices. And the question is, will you feel worse if you sell now and the market goes higher, or if you don't sell and the market goes lower? And I'm not an extremist. I'm just saying take some out of the middle and become more conservative.
That's Terry Savage. She's the smartest person on the air right now on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to take a break and come back. I want to talk to you. I want to ask you a couple things. I want to ask you about Apple because, you know, they're worried that they might not actually show growth next year. But you also wrote something about mobile devices and using your phone for banking. A couple of tips that you have that had not occurred to me. So will you stick around for that?
Absolutely.
It's 12:21. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here on this Wednesday afternoon. So is Terry Savage. Terry, talk to me about Apple stock. Now, they were saying the sales have been their lowest since maybe 2007 when it comes to iPhones. And I'm hearing that
The increases,
right. So I'm hearing that they're moving, that there's this notion that Apple stock should be considered now not so much a growth stock as a value stock. Can you explain that for me and why it's why Apple doesn't like that?
Yes, I will. Exactly. And I don't talk about individual stocks, but this is something that happens to growth stocks as they mature. And I remember going through this when I was on the board of directors of McDonald's in the 90s. Companies that started out as America's darling growth stocks at some point reached the law of diminishing returns.
Everybody's got an iPhone.
You know, they get bigger. The word saturation comes into play. That doesn't mean these companies can't grow. It means they can't grow at the same dramatic rates And a company's board of directors, I could tell you, feels very hurt, insulted, and upset when the investment community starts to think of them as a value stock based on the cash flow, based on the earnings, based on potential dividends, and not according it to higher multiples that come from expectations of dramatically increasing earnings every year.
So value
now,
stock, a value
company. But value stock is something people, different people want in their portfolio because they believe in consistent growth, but not dramatic growth. They believe that they will get repaid somehow in the form of dividends or share buybacks. And to a company that was a growth darling, it can be very, right. very hurtful. But as companies like McDonald's prove, you go on, you expand, you try new things, or you become a company that gets out of touch. I'm going to give you two examples. Way back when, McDonald's was a growth stock, and so was Avon. But Avon never made it. It got out of step. Women weren't home waiting for the doorbell to ring. Women had other jobs and so forth. And Avon just fell by the wayside. It was once the darling of growth stocks. McDonald's, for example, and I'm not an insider anymore, has proved that you can grow, you can expand, you can do things differently, become more efficient. And it's one of the best performing stocks in the Dow in the last 12 months. So Apple isn't going to fall apart. It will continue to grow. It just may not exhibit dramatic growth.
It's okay. I want to ask you about mobile devices too, and we'll do it moving from Apple because kind of a funny thing. Talking about Apple stock, when we were throwing it to the break, and I was saying Terry Savage was the smartest person in the studio. My iPhone, somehow lately Siri's been eavesdropping on me, and it started recording everything I said. I think because I said Savage, which is near Siri, it started to record my request, and it was going to make one, which kind of speaks to why you have to be careful when you're banking and doing things
yes.
on mobile devices, because you don't always know exactly what's going to happen.
You know, I cover two areas. I cover personal finance, and I always talk about the markets and from an investment point of view because I started my career as a founding member of the Chicago Board Options Exchange. I've lived in the markets forever and ever. So the personal finance side of me realized something, that as I travel, I want to check my bank balances. I do that every day or two to make sure there's nothing untoward happening on my credit cards. And I don't want to do that from my mobile phone. And so I started researching this, and I came up with a column about keeping your mobile money safe. It's at terrysavage.com. Let me give you a couple of tips that I think will be helpful for you. First, don't just launch a browser to get to your bank's website or credit card website. You download the app that the institution provides.
That's something I had not thought of.
Bank online, do it through the mobile app, okay? Number two, don't ever use public Wi-Fi to access your account. I mean, I love Starbucks. Don't sit in Starbucks and try to access your account on the public Wi-Fi. Someone wrote me after this column got posted, wait a minute, my bank's secure. Yeah, but you're not secure when you log into your bank and you put your name and your password in there, your username and password. Anybody could pick that up and then take it someplace and access your bank account or your credit card account. So you have to make sure that you are not using public Wi-Fi. If you're home or you have a secure Wi-Fi, that's when you use your mobile app.
I like that. Okay. And I like the fact that the app is not just for convenience, that there's added security there. I hadn't thought of that until I read your column, Terry Savage. Thanks very much for joining us.
And one more thing, don't pre-populate your name and password in your app. It saves time, but it makes it easier if someone takes your phone to get into your accounts.
Nice.
TerrySavage.com, all the details.
It's all at TerrySavage.com, and we'll talk some more about this and other things next Wednesday afternoon.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye. Terry Savage, you're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Kim, by the way, is watching the Bruce Rauner State of the State Address, so you don't have to, and she will have a summary of that coming up at 1 o'clock in the news, 1 o'clock this afternoon.
We will have it for you.
Scott Kleinberg was watching briefly, and then he was able to tear himself away to come down to the studio and join us on the Business Lunch. Scott, thank you for doing that.
Oh, thank you, Steve.
Made yourself just a little bit dumber by walking away from the state of the state to talk about Facebook and things such as that. One of the things I want to talk to you about is this. There was a study done of your friends on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
We call them friends, but they're not really our friends.
Yeah, yeah. And it's an Oxford University study, so, you know, it's a pretty good study.
It comes with an accent, so we have to believe it.
Exactly, right. Yes. And it basically says that if you take 150 people that are Facebook friends, that are your Facebook friends, 14 of them are actual friends that would be there for you if you needed anything. And 5 could be considered close friends.
Okay. Well, so 5, that's okay. Probably most people in their lives have 5 close friends.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But you always feel good when you're on Facebook and you're like, I have 2,000 friends. Well, you don't have 2,000 friends. You have acquaintances. You have people.
That's a very friendly thing for you to say.
You know.
You don't have 2,000 friends. Okay, so we've got that. And so I suppose it's not a way that we should, it's no measure that we should be bragging about. Right, is that what you're saying? Is that the point of it?
I definitely wouldn't brag about it, but you know, you see this kind of thing all the time. I mean, the study is great, but you see this kind of thing all the time. You see people, you know, they wish you a happy birthday, but you never hear from them otherwise. Those are the people they're talking
Somehow
about.
I've got a notification on my computer at home. I have a pop-up every time it's someone's birthday.
Yeah, yeah. Mine's the same way.
Just on your screen, no matter where you are?
Yep. It automatically pops up at the top and it tells you you have this event today.
Is that from Facebook?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There are calendars that will have people's birthdays that, you know, like Gmail does that. And that
That's what I was
thing.
Wondering.
But Facebook, I have set up where it lets me know at the start of each day what events I have. And because Facebook considers a birthday an event, it all falls under that.
So if I bring my computer in on Friday, you can help me kill that?
If you would like me to,
I'd
be happy to.
Facebook also is moving away from just the like button or the unlike button, right?
And yeah.
That's spreading worldwide, or what's the situation?
Yeah, they've been testing it in a few countries. It's been international only, and now within a few weeks, they say you're going to have different emoticons as emoji as your reaction. So you'll have angry, sad, wow, haha, and love.
I'm pretty sure that it's been 2 sessions since we've talked about emojis.
Has it been that long?
Right,
that's pretty good.
You had the shakes there a little bit.
I think they
started this in Australia or Scotland or their countries.
Scotland, Ireland, somewhere over there. Spain, I think, as well. They were testing a couple of different kinds. I know they tested LOL, and apparently that didn't work in terms of translation for everybody, so they got rid of that.
Uh-huh.
But the basic gist is you're still going to have your like button, but you'll also have a button where you can hover over it and you'll get the choice of the 5 emoticons and you can choose which one it makes you, you know, feel.
So that's coming now soon to a laptop near you.
A laptop, a desktop, and a phone near you, yes.
How long are we going to have to wait for this, Scott?
It looks like it's going to be a few weeks, within weeks. So it'll roll out, you know, over time. But the good thing is, I mean, you know, it's more stuff to go through. So instead of seeing something like, you know, you have 60 likes, maybe you'll have 20 likes, 20 wows. You'll get a whole bunch of wows. A whole bunch of sadness and that kind of thing.
That's another reason to get up in the morning.
There you go.
Twitter is, yes. By the way, Jim Dahlke, who writes for Chicago Inno, was in on Monday.
Okay.
And he tried that Facebook stadium thing.
Oh, yeah.
For the NFC Championship game.
Okay. What do you
and
think?
He thought it was okay. He liked Twitter better because Twitter, he could find more experts. I thought it sounded interesting because what it is they set up these separate feeds where you can live comment on events.
Right.
So you can live comment on, say, the NFC Championship game, and you're seeing what all your other friends are saying in live time.
Right.
So I like that because it would be confined to your 2,000 friends.
Yes, exactly.
Not the world. You know, it's a little more isolated. Anyway, Twitter, though, one of the raps against Twitter is, you know, there's a lot of ads. It's part of it.
Yep.
But they're kind of helping some people cheat a little bit to get around those ads.
Yeah. It looks like they're taking the people who are the most influential. They're not really necessarily defining how they come up with that. And they're serving them either less ads or no ads at all. So for some people...
So how's that working for you?
I have seen ads all along. They apparently, Steve, do not know who I am, which is very upsetting.
Well, you know... I'm not one of those people either, but I don't notice the ads. Where are the ads?
You see them in the iOS app and you see them at Twitter.com. You don't see them everywhere. Like I use TweetDeck for a lot of the day.
That's all I use is TweetDeck. Yeah.
So you don't notice it as much. And to be quite honest, I don't think ads are the biggest problem when it comes to Twitter in any way. I think that they want to differentiate themselves somehow and they want to say to people who are super popular, you know, here's a way that we're going to show you that we care by not showing you an ad.
So jump on Twitter, we'll jump off your back.
Yes, exactly. I think if Facebook did that, that, that would be a bigger story because Facebook ads are so noticeable and they're on the sides and they're in the feed and they're everywhere. I think it's a different type of thing if they do it in that place.
So you are not considered a VIP of Twitter. You're still seeing the ads.
I am still seeing the ads. I don't know what I have
to do. So we're thinking like a guy like John Cass, he's probably ad-free if he...
You know, he hasn't mentioned anything. I should probably look into that. But they say it's not just based on followers. So it could be if you have a really, really good influence or good engagement, that could be all you need.
Presidential debate tomorrow with or without Donald Trump. And Google's been trying something new, like a new way to get information about the candidates, or it's something in live real time, right?
It's a new way to follow what the candidates are saying and to research what they're saying in real time. So there's always this talk about how, you know, when a candidate says something and then they go back later and they fact check it and they say, well, wait a minute, your quote from 1998 says this.
Right.
Now you'll be able to do that in real time. So I haven't seen exact examples, but I'm assuming if you were to say, did Chris Christie say this, and you type in the quote, it would be able to return and say, in 2004, Chris Christie said the following, and you would be able to find out in real time as you watch, assuming you're Google searching during the debate. I think that's the thing that's interesting. They want to stand out. Google wants to stand out and give you this information in the search results. I think most people are going to search for that stuff on Twitter and talk about it with their friends.
So it's only going to be active during the debate?
I don't know if they're going to do it afterwards. They're showcasing it as part of a thing that you can do during the debate. But my guess is if you were to do it afterwards and ask the same question, it would tell you.
Okay.
It's just a much more robust response.
So I'm trying to think, since Donald Trump and Megyn Kelly's in the forefront right now, in the forefront, I think it was Megyn, or no, it actually was a CNBC interview where a interviewer or a questioner asked Trump something, and he said, I never said that. I think it was Rand Paul was Mark Zuckerberg's senator or something like that? Might not be Rand Paul. And he said, oh, I never said that.
Yep.
So this is the thing where you could type, did Donald Trump. Why couldn't you do that now?
I mean, you can do that now, but I think the way the results are presented, it will come up. Because, you know, like if you ask like a certain question, sometimes the answer comes up right at the top and then you have search results. I think that's what they're talking about. They're trying to find a way to make it so the answer is very apparent, very quick, very scannable, and right at the top.
So it's highlighted. You know it's right there.
Yes.
I was talking earlier about how Siri's been eavesdropping on me. And she'll start recording and spewing back at me when I'm not expecting it.
Right.
Which you described as sort of weird.
Yeah, it is weird.
But then there's another Safari bug, an Apple bug that you talked about.
Yeah. It's been hitting around the world today, last night. A lot of people have been talking about it. There's basically this setting in Safari that lets you have search suggestions. So you can go to like the search box and it'll like bring things up. It's an optional feature, but it comes as part of the browser. And there's some kind of weird thing that's happening where when it's on, a lot of people, it happened to me once, it'll just crash the browser completely. But it's happening on Macs, on iPads, on iPhones, anything that uses Safari.
It's only Safari.
Yeah.
So I use Firefox.
Then it wouldn't happen to
you. So when my computer freezes up, as it's been doing lately, I can't blame this bug.
No, it might be operator error or something else.
You sound like an IT guy. Scott Kleinberg from the Chicago Tribune writes about social media. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
We'll see you again soon. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Steve Alexander, Kim Gordon, and Dolly McCarthy. The Business Lunch, the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. All right, we all know the presidential candidates are working Iowa again today. The caucus is coming up next Monday, and it's all about message. It's all about marketing, right? So what can business learn from the presidential campaigns, the marketing of the campaigns? Dr. Bruce Newman is a professor of marketing at DePaul University, and he's got a new book out. It's called The Marketing Revolution in Politics, What Recent U.S. Presidential Campaigns Can Teach Us About Effective Marketing. And he joins us on the phone line now. Dr. Newman, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And in thinking about talking to you and going over recent campaigns and such, everyone talks about and thinks about Donald Trump, and I don't know what the marketing plan is there other than the fact that it's been remarkably successful. I mean, can you see a defined marketing impact on Donald Trump?
Oh, absolutely. You know, what he's doing is he's following the Obama 2008 and 2012 model, which essentially relies on big data, social media, micro-targeting to get your message out. At the same time, he's He's doing what we see in e-commerce, like an Amazon, where people are going direct to the producer, to the manufacturer, and doing a end run around the retailer and the wholesaler. Same thing is happening in the political distribution channel, where someone like a Donald Trump, who doesn't have the inside track as a party insider, can go around those people and go direct to the voter in the way that he has, which has resulted in his success.
I see him going around the party apparatus and the media in many ways, going around directly to the voter. I don't so much see him using the data and all of that, but you see that in his campaign too.
Well, I see that he's utilizing a very sophisticated process to build up his customer base. If you want to come to his event, you have to give him an email address. He's able to take his brand and respond to the anxiety that exists in the country, and he's able to take this technology and vis-a-vis social media, using Twitter, as we all know, he's sending messages out to people, and they're responding to him. And he's building up this relationship, which is what marketing is all about. It's all about building up that relationship with your customer base.
A lot of business is fitting or fulfilling a need. Some parts of business are creating a need for your business. Which is he doing?
I would say he's doing both. He's responding, as I said before, to this anxiety that exists. But he's creating the need for new leadership. There's a perception in the country that the current administration has not been strong enough, and he's creating the need on the part of people that say, you know what, I'm sick and tired of the weak leadership that they perceive on the part of the Obama administration, and he's creating a niche for himself as the person who has the strength, who has the personality, who has the money, if he chooses to use it, which, by the way, he hasn't, which has also upended this whole campaign. Because the person who had the most money with the most in a super PAC was
Jeb Bush.
Mr. Bush. Jeb
right.
Bush. Well, where is he now? And Mr. Trump hasn't spent a dollar until he came to January in a paid advertisement. So he's getting all this free publicity. This is all the result of the technology that I'm talking about in my book.
All right, so let's bring that from, you know, the streets of Des Moines or Nashua to the Loop or to the business in Downers Grove or Arlington Heights or wherever. What can a businessman or a marketing professional learn from, and I don't want to say just Donald Trump, but you write a lot about mm-hmm. Barack Obama and certainly other presidential candidates. What mm-hmm. does a marketing professional take from them and move into her business or his business?
What they do is they take all of this technology and they integrate it into the medium that is the most important today in business, which is the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And they take that technology, they create a dashboard. For example, a MetLife insurance company went from 40 clicks for an insurance agent speaking to a client down to one click with an integrative dashboard on their computer, so they understood the history of that person. Same way that the Obama people did it, with a model built on 1,000 variables, put a dashboard into the internet system, allowed any strategic person working in the campaign, as I'm sure I don't know firsthand, but I'm sure it's happening with all the candidates, including Trump, and they're able to alter the advertisements that you're viewing as you surf their website online. So the message is, companies have to get in tune with the new technological advances that exist, the big data, customer analytics, social media, micro-targeting, and use it to integrate it into a marketing process. And, of course, in the book I lay out 7 marketing lessons that a company should follow to be successful.
The name of the book, the name of the book is The Marketing Revolution in Politics. The author, Dr. Bruce Newman, a professor of marketing at DePaul University. Dr. Newman, you helped a lot. Thank you very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
You bet. Bill and Wendy just around the corner here on the Wintrust Business Lunch.